believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, and became a lawyer. He got into politics, became a Virginia state senator, and ultimately Virginia's attorney general. After losing a race to be Virginia's governor, his life was transformed from slamming prison doors shut to opening inmates' hearts to hope. Today, he's the president and CEO of Prison Fellowship Ministries. His name, Mark Early. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now here's Jack.
We're with Mark Early, the president and CEO of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Mark, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Jack, it's an honor to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Absolutely. Well, I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia. It's a city nestled in between Norfolk and Virginia Beach on the south side of Virginia. And my dad and mom neither went to college. My brother and I were the first in our families to go to college. My dad was an apprentice at the Norfolk Naval Shipyard, enlisted in the Navy, World War II, got out, came back, became an engineer through an apprentice program, and worked for 35 years at the Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Portsmouth, Virginia. My mom was a substitute teacher and secretary, and my brother and I never wanted for love. I grew up in a family where every morning somebody told me they loved me, and every evening they told me they loved me. So it was a great childhood growing up.
What were the biggest things your mom taught you and the biggest things your dad taught you, Mark?
Well, I think, you know, they probably taught me more by example than verbally. You know, I think one of the great legacies of my parents to me is their faithfulness to each other. Over now, they're both still alive. They're 87. They've been married over 55 years. And I think from my dad, I'd learned the value of hard work and a good, honest character. You know, they were just very steady, very stable. They were always there. You could always count on them. And, you know, that may not seem like much, but it's a lot. And, you know, I'll forever be grateful to them.
You earned a law degree from Marshall White School of Law, and eventually you get into politics. Why?
Well, I didn't start down that road. When I was in college, I thought I was going to go into the full-time ministry. I majored in religion, and then for 2 years after that, I worked in campus ministry, 1 year outside of Philadelphia at Westchester University, and then for 2 years at the University of the Philippines. And it was really when I was living in the Philippines in the late 1970s that I began to get interested in government and policy and politics. And basically, as I was working with college students in the Philippines, I realized from them that the sun didn't rise on the rest of the world with freedom and liberty and opportunity like it did in America every day. You know, I'd grown up thinking America was most of the world, and I realized really quick it wasn't. And I realized in those 2 years in the Philippines that you can't run a country, i.e. America, off the inspiration and conviction of its founders unless there's a recommitment to those core principles and first principles in every generation. We really won't have a country to hand to the next generation. So I saw the beauty and the hope of my country from afar, despite its failings, and wanted to give myself to public policy. So I came back, went to law school, and with the sole purpose, really, of hoping one day to get involved in government and politics, and it worked out.
You were a state senator in Virginia for 10 years, and then you become the Virginia Attorney General in 98. What does a state attorney general do?
Well, in basic terms, the state attorney general manages the law department for any given state. We had about 200 attorneys and another 100 administrative personnel, and we represent all of the state agencies of the state, from universities to Department of Transportation to Division of Motor Vehicles to you know, defending legislators or the governor if they're sued. Another big role of the attorney generals in most states, it's certainly true in Virginia, is to prosecute felonies when they're appealed from the local court. So we handled all felonies that were appealed, all death penalty cases. The attorney general is also in charge of enforcing the consumer affairs laws of its state, overseeing the public charities and their regulations. So it's a pretty comprehensive job, and quite frankly, for someone who's interested in law and politics, it's one of the best-kept secrets in terms of a great job in the United States.
A lot of young people today are very interested in this political campaign, tremendous interest. If there's a young listener thinking about going into politics as a career, what advice would you give them?
I'd say do it. It's a wonderful opportunity to serve. I don't regret one day that I spent in public service. I loved every minute of it. I'm excited to see the number of people that are interested in this campaign, particularly among the younger generation. We haven't seen that in a number of years, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, a democracy is held together over the years by the willingness of its citizens not only to vote, but to be active in their communities, to support political candidates, to make their views heard, their voices known, to be activists in the best sense of the word.
The partisanship, the animosity between the two parties today, everybody rails against it. What's the solution? How do we get out of this and work together?
Well, it's not really the fault of the parties, in my view. It really reflects a divided country. We have a division in the country over some very basic fundamental values, and they show up in our parties. And as a result of that, you know, a lot more is at stake in terms of the party who is in control today than it was, you know, 30 years ago. I mean, in the 1950s, whether the Democrats or the Republicans were in control, it didn't necessarily make a huge difference in a lot of areas. The differences were marginal on a lot of things, but those differences have really grown in terms of the approach to education. You know, are we going to encourage school choice, or are we going to stick with a large government-controlled education system? The difference on taxes, whether we should have bigger government, less government, tax cuts for people, or people paying more taxes for more services. The whole issue of life, you know, whether we're going to honor the sanctity and dignity of human life at its earliest stages and at its latest stages. These are very, very fundamental issues that a democratic society is finding itself now wrestling with, and there's a huge gulf and huge separation in America, and it's showing up in the two parties, and I think that's why it's so divisive.
We're talking to Mark Early, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR, brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Mark Early, who ran for Virginia governor and lost. Mark, what did that experience teach you?
Well, I think it taught me that I'm glad I ran, even though I lost. You know, a lot of people, when they lose, become bitter. By God's grace, I didn't become bitter, and it was a great experience. And I also learned that, you know, if you have your hopes set on something and you really have a goal, even if you don't get it, it's not the end of the world. I think a lot of people think if they've worked for something long and hard, like you do on a governor's race for a number of years, and you don't win, you sort of can lose your sense of self-identity. I've seen that happen with a number of candidates, and they never quite recover from it. But for me, it was just a good reminder that, you know, it's not so much whether you win or lose, but it's whether you were willing to get in the arena. And, of course, I wanted to win, but having not won, it didn't really slow me down too much. So I'm grateful for that.
You then transform from slamming prison doors shut to opening inmates' hearts to hope.
I did, and it wasn't something I was looking for or expected. In fact, the day after I lost the governor's race, I got up early in the morning, and over the years I've just tried to set aside a time early in the mornings to pray and read the scriptures, try to get my head screwed on straight. And I wrote down in my journal the day after the election loss things I believe today. And one of the things I wrote down was that, you know, this door having been shut, I'm excited about the door that's going to be open. And it wasn't about, but 2 weeks later, I got a call from Chuck Colson, who, of course, had served in the White House with President Nixon, had gotten caught up in Watergate, served a short prison term of 7 months in federal prison, got out, gave the rest of his life to helping inmates and their family, founded Prison Fellowship. And he called me. I really didn't know him. I'd met him once before. I'd read a couple of his books, was an admirer of him and the ministry and work of Prison Fellowship. But he said, "Mark, I'm sorry you lost the election. But I wanted to know if you'd be willing to talk to me and our board about coming to Prison Fellowship and becoming president. We've been looking for someone to engage in a transition of leadership with me over the coming years." So, you know, I was flattered to get the call, but I really wasn't interested. And the reason I wasn't interested is that I couldn't see how it would be worth my time at the midpoint of my life giving myself and investing my time in prisoners, because I had a stereotype of prisoners, and that is that they didn't have a future. They didn't have a hope. If they were locked up, they deserved to be there. And the longer they were there, the better off I was and my loved ones in the community. So I had a pretty dim view of the prospects of prisoners, and I wasn't particularly interested in investing my time or life in them.
Let's talk about the prisons in America. We have 2.3 million people today in prison, more than any other country. In the 70s, we had 250,000 people. So it's a tenfold increase in 30 years. The female prison population has exploded. Why this tremendous explosion, Mark?
Well, the tremendous explosion is due to a couple of factors, and I'll sort of simplify them. But one is that we've changed our policies in the U.S. about who we put in prison. And I was a big part of that during my 10 years in the Senate, from 87 to 97 in Virginia, and the 4 years as Attorney General. We in Virginia, like most other states, Michigan included, got tough on crime. We abolished parole. We instituted three strikes and you're out. We lowered the age at which juveniles could be tried as adults from 16 to 14. We instituted truth in sentencing. We built more prisons across the country. And as a result of a lot of these laws, we just ended up putting a lot more people in prison for a lot longer. And as a result, as you say, the numbers went from about 275,000 in the late 70s to 2.3 million today. But what I didn't realize while I was, you know, getting tough on crime and ratcheting down on people we put in prison, what I didn't realize is that a lot of these people going into prison, they're not Ted Bundys, most of them. They're people who have got a drug and alcohol problem. That's led them into crime. 80% of the men in prison, in addition to having some sort of substance abuse problem, grew up in a home without a father. And I told you a minute ago, when Chuck called me and asked me to come to Prison Fellowship, I wasn't interested. But I had a change of heart, and that change of heart was that I began to see that the people in prison, simply because they had done something wrong, were not beyond rehabilitation and hope. But they weren't getting any rehabilitation, and nobody was offering them any hope. They were just simply being written off and warehoused in prison. And as a result, they were coming out more bitter, more criminally savvy than when they went in. Kind of like if you've got a pit bull and you put him in a cage for a month and poke him with a stick every once in a while and hope he's going to be a better behaved dog when he comes out. Well, he's not. And so, you know, with this large number of people in prison, you know, what we do at Prison Fellowship is try to provide hope, try to provide opportunities for them to change their heart and their character based on the teachings and principles of Jesus, and we're seeing incredible results. But the growth in this prison population is incredible. You know, this 2.3 million figure kind of makes people's eyes glaze over, but what really brings it down to a fine point is when you realize that one out of every 100 adults in America is locked up, and one out of every 32 adults in America is either locked up or on probation and parole. And you really can't sustain a country for very long if that is a growing trend, and it continues to be a growing trend in America.
A mutual friend of ours, Mike Timmis, also extremely involved with Prison Fellowship, you know, he'll say that Japan has 100 million people, 80,000 imprisoned. The state of Michigan, 10 million people, 56,000 in prison.
Right.
Many, many for drugs. Many people believe we should legalize drugs. Mark, what do you think about legalizing drugs?
Well, I don't think we ought to legalize drugs, but what I do think we ought to do is, rather than lock people up who are users, is get them some sort of substance abuse treatment. It needs to be more available, and we need to look at alternatives to incarceration. You know, in prison fellowship, where we're coming from, we try to look at biblical principles that can be applied to the criminal justice sphere of society. And one of the biblical principles in the scriptures is shalom, and the idea of well-being in a community. So when someone breaks the law or harms the community, they need to pay back the community. The community needs to be restored, and they need to be restored if possible. We're not doing that in the U.S. primarily. All we're doing is taking people that we don't like what they're doing and locking them up for long periods of time, and they're coming out with the same drug problem they went in with. So I think with drugs, it's a question of getting people more treatment when they come out of prison, helping them get involved in a local parish or church, getting them a mentor, helping them to get stabilized. And a lot of these people don't need to come back. But right now in the U.S., we have 700,000 people coming out of prison every year. 66% of them are being rearrested after 3 years, and 50% are back in prison. I mean, if this was a corporation, you'd shut it down if that's the track record they had in trying to fix a product that was sent to them.
Why the tremendous explosion of female prisoners?
Primarily drugs. The methamphetamine problem in the U.S. has really increased the number of females in prison. We're also finding, you know, as with most men in prison, they didn't have a father when they were growing up. Either it was totally absent or constructively absent. A lot of women in prison, the majority of them, over 50%, are coming from abusive backgrounds where they've either been physically, mentally, or sexually abused growing up or by another male in their adult life. So abuse, both child abuse and domestic abuse, as well as drugs, is fueling the growth of females in prisons, as well as a general coarsening of the culture. You know, you see it on YouTube and on the news where girls are, there are many more girls out on the street now than they used to. They're engaging in activity we used to just associate with males, of fighting, and it's all kind of blending together for a perfect storm. Females are the fastest growing subpopulation in America's prisons. And of course, the vast majority of them have children, and that compounds the tragedy, because we know that the greatest predictor of whether a child goes to prison is not the neighborhood they grow up in, the color of their skin, their education, their economic status, but it's whether or not they had a mother or father in prison.
We're talking to Mark Early. When we come back, we'll ask him what Prison Fellowship is doing in that regard. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Mark Early, the president and CEO of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Mark, you've stated that children whose parents are incarcerated are five times more likely to go to prison themselves. What is Prison Fellowship doing for the children of the prisoners?
Jack, we've had a program now for over 25 years called Angel Tree, and basically it's an outreach to prisoners' children. And basically what we found out is one of the best ways to communicate God's love and God's hope to a prisoner is for someone to love their kids. Again, most of the people who are in prison are not serial killers. They're not predators. Some are, and they have no conscience at all. But a lot of other people in prison realize they've really messed up royally. They have a lot of guilt and shame about it. And one of the biggest areas of guilt and shame and regret is the fact they're not able to be the mother or the father to their kids that they should have been. And so we've found when churches or anyone else reaches out to these children and loves them, the prisoners, all of a sudden, their heart starts to change. I think most of your listeners can identify with that. If somebody loves your kids, you really appreciate it. You identify with it, and you're drawn to them. So this program actually began 25 years ago. It's a great story how it started. There was a lady in a federal prison in Birmingham, Alabama, named Mary Kay Beard. She'd been a safecracker and a bank robber on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. She was arrested, sentenced to 17 years in prison. When she was in prison, her life radically changed as a result of getting to know God. And when she was in prison, she noticed that as Christmas would approach, the female inmates would start to put on their bed piles of things that they had been given by the authorities in the prison, toothpaste, toothbrushes, soap, things like, you know, just personal toiletry articles. Some women had three piles on their bed, some one, some four. She couldn't figure out what they were doing. Well, what they were doing is this is what they were going to give to their kids when they came to visit because they had nothing else to give. And what amazed her is when the kids got these gifts, which most kids would turn their nose up at, the kids were like incredibly excited. And she realized that the gulf of separation between these women in prison and their kids was so great that the least little outreach or show of love went a long way. So when she got out of prison, she put a Christmas tree up in the Birmingham Mall with the names of 300 children on it from the inmates she had been in with. And they went in a period of like a week. People took names off the Christmas tree, got a gift, sent it to the prison for the child, for the mother to give the child. And she later came on our staff, and Angel Tree was born. And this year, we'll serve close to 500,000 children of prisoners around the United States through local churches, where individuals in those churches will receive the name of a prisoner's child. They'll get a gift for that child. They'll take it to that child's home and share it with them in their parent's name who's in prison and share with them what Christmas is all about. That's how Angel Tree started, and now it's not only in all 50 states in the U.S. serving 500,000 children a year, but it's also in a lot of other countries around the U.S., around the world as a result.
This has become your life, your passion, Mark Early. What have the prisoners taught you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I remember when I started going into prison, you know, I'd been into prisons as a state senator and as attorney general, but it was always as, you know, kind of a government official, and I saw prisoners with a number and a sentence date and an out date. That's about it. I didn't really see them as human beings, I'm ashamed to say. And I thought when I started going into prisons with prison fellowship, working with prisoners, that, you know, I was going to be the one who was going to be giving a lot to them. And, you know, but really it turned out that I always benefit more when I go into prison, as so does every other volunteer that I've talked to. I think what they've taught me is most of the people behind bars in America today are not that different than people in my family, or not that people different than people I know. These are people who've usually messed up with drugs and alcohol. It's often led them into other crimes of violence or property crimes. These are people who, a lot of them, did not grow up with a father. They didn't grow up in a home like I did, where my parents were telling me they loved me every day, giving me a lot of affirmation. So what I've learned is that these inmates, if they're given love and if they're given hope, can, many of them who want to change, can change. And I've learned that the prison system isn't designed to do that. The prison system is simply designed to lock people up and warehouse them until they get out. So there's a huge opportunity today in the United States for people, and most of the people who are motivated to go in and work with prisoners are people who, you know, whose own lives have been transformed by Jesus and by God. When they're willing to go in and share the love of God with these inmates behind bars, they change, just like we can change with love. The power of love is an incredibly great force in the world, and when I see it unleashed behind bars, we see these prisoners change, and they've taught me the power of love.
You're very close to Chuck Colson, an iconic figure in America, a great American. What's the biggest things you've learned from Chuck Colson?
Well, I've learned so much from Chuck. You know, it's been such a privilege to work with him over the last 7 years. He's a great mentor. He's a great example. I think a couple of things I've learned from Chuck is the importance of perseverance. You know, from the day Chuck's life was radically transformed, and he, you know, converted from a self-centered individual to a God-centered individual on his way to prison. You know, he's never looked back, and, you know, he gives 110% of himself and 110% of every day to serving people, and that's been a great example for me. And I think the level of integrity that he has brought to prison fellowship from the earliest days of its founding until today, has also been something that has been inspirational to me and something I hope we can continue for generations to come.
We're in troubled times. People are worried about losing their job, giving up, living within their standards again. If a listener's tonight thinking, Mark, this is great, but why should I be concerned about prisoners? What would you say to those listeners?
Well, I think two things. Most of your listeners is going to know someone in prison, and they're going to know someone in prison who they also know, with the right kind of help and encouragement, doesn't need to stay there and could have a very productive life. You know, with one out of 32 adults in America either locked up or on probation and parole, I visit churches and talk in churches all the time. I ask people to raise their hand if they've had a loved one or a family member, extended family member, or a friend in prison in the last 5 years. And over 50% of the hands go up. I don't care whether the congregation is white, black, Latino, or whether it's in a suburb or the inner city. So they ought to care because they really have a neighbor in prison, and many of them have brothers and sisters in prison. But the second reason they ought to care is if they're someone who calls themselves a follower of Jesus, we have to care, because Jesus said, if you visit a prisoner, you visit me. We see when we read the scriptures that many of the men and women God used in pivotal roles in the drama of salvation history were men and women who'd be locked up today. You know, Moses was a murderer, and yet God chose him to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt, personally handed in the Ten Commandments, an incredible figure in the drama of how God communicated and expressed his love to men. St. Paul, who we revere today, described himself and was known in his community as a violent man. He was a co-conspirator in murder, and yet he was chosen to, you know, by Jesus himself to be such a pivotal figure, an apostle in the early church. So, you know, it's just like God to take the people that the world would say don't have a future and don't have a hope because of what they've done. It's just like God to take those people and through his grace and through his mercy and through the power of his love to put their lives back together and use them to be some of the great leaders in society. Chuck Colson is an example, the founder of our ministry. So people ought to care because God cares. And, you know, that's sort of the sufficient and compelling reason for me. And quite frankly, it's something that I overlooked for many years, and I'm ashamed to say it.
We're talking to Mark Early, and I'm Jack Grisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Mark Early, former Virginia Attorney General, who transformed from slamming prison doors shut to opening inmates' hearts to hope as the president of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Mark, Prison Fellowship is in 113 countries, 100,000 volunteers. Some of these countries, you get imprisoned for helping these prisoners. How did this happen?
Well, you know, Chuck started this ministry, Chuck Colson, 32 years ago when he came out of prison after Watergate. He made a commitment when he came out that he'd spend the rest of his life bringing hope, the hope of Jesus Christ, to prisoners and their families. And about 5 to 6 years after that, England approached us here in the U.S. and said, we'd like to start a prison fellowship. And so the international side of Prison Fellowship was born. And again, today it's in 113 countries around the world. I'm the president of the work here in the U.S. We have an international president, Ron Nickel, who's from Canada, and he oversees the international work. And we're structured, I think, in an interesting way. I think it was a real move of wisdom on Chuck and the board of Prison Fellowship in the early days. This is a ministry that doesn't send Americans to other countries to work with people in prison, but other countries basically petition to become a charter country with Prison Fellowship. So every country that has a Prison Fellowship, whether it's Prison Fellowship Bolivia, Prison Fellowship Japan, Prison Fellowship Philippines, Prison Fellowship Costa Rica, all of them are supported financially, internally in those countries. Their leadership is indigenous to those countries. Their board is made up of the countries. The only thing we require in the charter is that, you know, they subscribe to the Apostles' Creed and that they agree that they're going to work with all denominations, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox within the Christian faith. So one of the things that makes Prison Fellowship unique is that we truly represent the face of Christianity across the globe. If you go to South America, our work is predominantly Catholic in many of those countries. If you go to Eastern Europe, it's predominantly run and led by Eastern Orthodox. So it's just a great example of people coming together to work together with a common faith and a common goal, and that is to serve prisoners and their families. And in many of these countries, the prison conditions are atrocious. Prison's bad enough in the U.S. I've spent time behind bars, not because I was incarcerated, but I've spent a number of hours and days behind bars in American prisons, and I'm always thankful I can come out when I want to. But in these other prisons, I mean, it's like dungeons in medieval times in many countries and third world countries. There's no clean water, there's no plumbing, there's no medical care, there's absolutely nothing for these inmates to do with their time. And in a lot of prisons around the world, and a lot of people don't realize this, if you go to prison, your kids go to prison with you, and they're at incredible risk of sexual exploitation and abuse in these prisons. So our work in many prisons around the world is not simply in communicating words of hope, but in engaging in acts of mercy and compassion to try to just raise the level of survival to a level where they can actually be offered some hope.
These challenging times that we're living through right now, a lot of people have a lot of fear, the uncertainty, and they're trying to figure out how to get through this adversity. What advice would you give them, Mark Early?
Well, I think the first bit of advice would be don't be afraid. You know, the commandment that occurs most often in the Bible is not love one another or love God, but it's don't be afraid. Every time God talks to somebody about how he wants them to live, he has to remind them, don't be afraid. So fear is the great enemy of life. It's the great enemy of faith. And it really is a command that we shouldn't be fearful. And I think, you know, that's something everybody struggles with, whether it's in small ways or big ways. But I just don't think we have that option. I think despair is a sin. I think people ought to be hopeful. I mean, regardless of the economic difficulties we have here in the U.S., and they are real, this is still the richest country in the world. It's the most prosperous country in the world. It's a world with the greatest opportunity economically, educationally, in any way you can describe it. And, you know, I've visited enough third world countries around the world to know that, you know, three-quarters of the world would trade places with us in an instant, even in our worst of economic times. So we've got an awful lot to be thankful for. And, you know, I know in our family, one of the things we're doing, you know, is we've seen the 401ks, you know, shrink, you know, dramatically, is we're just reminding ourselves of all the things we've got to be thankful for. What's the worst case scenario? Well, maybe we're going to work longer, or maybe we're going to have to do without some things we have. But none of those things are really, you know, going to make a huge difference in our lives, and I think that's true for most Americans. So we've got an awful lot to be thankful for, and I think in tough times, it's a great opportunity for us to get the focus off of ourselves and get it on other people who, around us in our communities and around the world who do have greater needs, and to step up and serve somebody else.
You meet someone who's been a victim of crime, and they say, Mr. Early, I'd love to forgive, but I don't know how to forgive that prisoner.
Well, that's tough. You know, I worked in my role as a prosecutor when I was attorney general with enough victims to know, you know, you really don't tell somebody to forgive. You can't make them forgive. That's something that they have to grapple with, and it's a tough situation. And, you know, people can forgive, but they're often scarred for life with the impact of the crime upon themselves or their loved ones. I mean, I had many families that we worked with as we prosecuted those who had inflicted harm upon their loved ones who, you know, lost a family member as a result of murder. They'll never get over that. They may come to a place where they can forgive that prisoner, but they'll never come to a place where their life is the same. So at Prison Fellowship, we have a lot of empathy with victims. We work a lot with prisoners to get them to make restitution to their victims. to engage in victim-offender reconciliation if the victim is willing to do that. It can never be forced on a victim. It has to be something that they want to do in their own time. But there's a lot of reconciliation that can occur, and one of the great examples we're seeing of that in the world today is in Rwanda, where there's incredible reconciliation going on between the perpetrators of the genocide there several years ago and the victims. And the perpetrators, as they're coming out of prison, are being required to build homes in the communities where they might have killed someone in this genocide. I mean, these were neighbors killing neighbors. It was an awful thing. And we've developed a program there called the Sycamore Tree Project, or Umuvumo in Rwandan, where prisoners and offenders go through a multiple-day reconciliation exercise. And again, it only can happen when there is true repentance on the part of the criminal and a true willingness to engage in forgiveness on the part of the offender. And that's something God has to work in people's hearts. You can't force that to happen.
Mark Early, last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think to have a sense of destiny. I think a lot of young people go through life with small dreams and small ambitions, and I think we were created and destined for great things and serving other people. So I encourage my kids all the time to think big, to ask God how He wants to use their life in a big way to help people, not just in their backyard but around the world. And I encourage every young person to have a big dream about how they can impact the world in a positive way, not only locally, but nationally and globally.
Mark Early, what a man, what a servant. You've truly surrendered to God, and you're doing what He wants you to do in His master plan. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Jack. It's great to be with you.
Our guest next Sunday will be a great lady. Local lady Dr. Susan Youngs of Oakwood Hospital. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.